You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. Tobacco killed 100 million people in the 20th century, and at the rate it's going, will kill an almost unbelievable 1 billion people in the 21st, with a high number of fatalities in the global south. It's the single largest preventable cause of death. Half of lifetime users will die from smoking, while secondhand smoke alone kills 50,000 people a year in the United States. In a field where many academics are secretly funded by the tobacco industry, very few people can speak to this subject like Stanford historian of science Robert Proctor, who's written the definitive book on the subject. It's titled Golden Holocaust: Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition, and it's published by UC Press. A book which, in an earlier version, was unsuccessfully subpoenaed by the tobacco industry. He's also the author of The Nazi War on Cancer and Cancer Wars, and has testified numerous times against Big Tobacco. I'm very pleased to be joined by Robert Proctor in KPFA Studios. I wonder if I could start by asking you a seemingly simple question. What's in a cigarette?
The cigarette is much more complex than people realize. We have secret documents from the industry which show that they spent literally tens of billions of dollars on cigarette design over the past 50 years, basically creating a perfect addicting engine. And so inside the cigarette, it's not just tobacco rolled in paper. You've got all kinds of compounds. 614 different compounds have been listed as being in ingredients, and these range from things like Rose of Latakia, or cinnamon oil and chamomile oil, to things like castoreum, which is a secretion from the anal gland of the Siberian beaver, or civet cat extract, or civet absolute, which is an extract from the comparable part of the civet cat. So it's really a witch's brew of ingredients, and some are put in there as flavorants, others are put in there as psychoactive, psychodynamic substances, as I say, to make a perfect addicting engine.
One of the things that I was fairly appalled to see that makes its way into cigarettes is actually radioactive substances.
That's right.
How so?
Yeah. Well, what happens is the fertilizers that are used in the tobacco plant are usually superphosphates to keep the nitrates down. And those superphosphates typically come from Florida, and they have a very high uranium content. And through the decay chain, the uranium decays into lead, and then the lead into polonium-210. And that comes up both through the roots and into the leaf, but also as fallout from the fertilizers that are spread around the leaf. And so you end up inhaling a huge amount of radioactivity. And this is virtually unknown to smokers. And it's something that the industry has not wanted ordinary smokers to know about for understandable reasons. So much so that in 1978, there's a secret document that says we really got to make sure people don't know about this. We don't want to wake the sleeping giant of polonium. We don't want what they call a three-mile Marlboro. And this is the most important source of radioactivity to which humans are exposed. More than X-rays. Yeah, certainly more in a deadly sense, because it's alpha radiation, which is a particle. It's emitted in the lungs. The polonium sticks in the tar of the cigarette and is trapped in the lungs and then just keeps emitting alpha radiation. And it's very different being in your lungs, because your lungs are much more vulnerable to alpha radiation than, say, your digestive tract, where there's a lot of cell shedding. So it's really quite grotesque.
Have there been studies on the consequences of that exposure to cigarette smokers and presumably the people around them?
Well, it's known in animal studies that breathing this stuff can kill you. In fact, a microscopic amount, so small you can't even see it, is enough to kill you. This is an extremely powerful carcinogen. The problem is, with smoking, there are also thousands of other poisons and hundreds of other carcinogens, so it's very hard to disaggregate how many deaths are actually caused by this particular compound.
Sure. Well, what about the filter? The tobacco industry in the past has claimed that filters help make the cigarette
right,
purer or cleaner. What's the filter all about?
Well, that's certainly one of the biggest myths about cigarettes. I mean, the cigarette is essentially an embodied physical fraud. There's deception we know about the tobacco industry lying about the health effects of its products, but the object itself is fraudulent. Filters are not filters. They're more like smoking speed bumps or something. Basically, all the filter does, you can make a filter arbitrarily tight, and if you tighten it enough, you just squeeze it by your hands, nothing will come through, and therefore it's not like smoking at all. It's just like holding a stick in your mouth. On the other hand, if you loosen it way up, the same amount of smoke will come through. They're all made loose enough so that the same amount of smoke comes through. Think about it. Why are there no filters on cigars? You know, if filters were doing something for health, you'd find them on cigars, but you don't. It was already known in the 1930s that filters are completely bogus and fraudulent. And in fact, that's one of the kind of tragic ironies is that the one company that was really recognizing this, the American Tobacco Company, they were very aware that the filters were fraudulent in the 1930s. They refused to go down that path. And as a result, were swamped by the other companies, Reynolds and Philip Morris, which made filters, fooled people, and went on and did a big business in the fraud.
So how does the modern cigarette compare to untreated tobacco, I guess, rolled up? You've mentioned all of these different things added for flavor, for other reasons. One thing that you argue is that the cigarette is also designed to be as addictive as possible.
Right.
So how is that done? And if you took those things out, would tobacco be benign or is it problematic in itself?
It's certainly already problematic no matter how you do it. American spirit cigarettes, which are supposedly more natural, you know, they're less
claimed to be additive free and seem to be sort of marketed to the left, interestingly.
Right. Yeah, the Bay Area, it's about 3% of the market, which is quite high. It's high in New Mexico and Arizona. They're completely bogus, too. And in fact, they've been bought by R.J. Reynolds for upwards of $350 million. So they're part of this industrial cigarette enterprise already. It's certainly true that the tobacco industry has added all kinds of garbage to cigarettes. They add things that make it easier to inhale. They add ammonia, which freebases the nicotine molecule and turns it into essentially what I call crack nicotine. They add levulinic acid, which increases the efficacy of the binding of the nicotine molecule in the brain. They add menthol, which is a kind of anesthetic and makes it easier to inhale and makes the poison go down easier. So all of those things are designed to make it easier for kids to start smoking. I remember that the people who start smoking are on average about 12 years old. And I know there are cases where people as young as 4 and 5 are addicted to cigarettes, and the youngest are even 2 and 3. As we see on the internet from China and Indonesia. So some very young kids get addicted. And a lot of the stuff that they put in cigarettes is to attract kids, in the same way that almost all tobacco ads are really youth-directed, because if you don't start smoking by the age of 21, you probably won't start at all. So they know they have to get those very early age kids, and a lot of these chemicals are added. Now, would it be better if there were no chemicals? Well, maybe slightly. But I think of that as sort of like, which is it better to be run over by a Prius or by a Ford Explorer? I mean, it really doesn't make a difference. The tobacco leaf is so complex itself, naturally, that just inhaling those burning proteins, burning sugars, burning nitrates, all these compounds, you got to remember there's lead and arsenic in a cigarette, there's formaldehyde, there's we mentioned the polonium, but there's many other extreme poisoning, cyanide, that even the natural leaf is just as deadly. Now, I should add one little caveat to that. You could make tobacco in such a way that it would be less deadly, and the way you do that is make it in such a way so that the smoke pH is above 8. Now, what that would do is that would mean it would not be inhaled. You could get the nicotine straight through your mouth rather than inhaling it. And as a result, that would be a truly less deadly cigarette. But certainly American Spirit and none of the other commercial brands have done anything like that. And I think actually that's one of the things the FDA will do is mandate that all cigarettes have to produce an 8-plus pH smoke. And that would essentially end most of the lung cancer epidemic.
in effect, who would turn cigarettes into something equivalent to cigars and pipes. Is that right?
That's right.
That you might get mouth cancer, but you wouldn't get lung cancer.
That's right. It would turn the clock back 100 years. I mean, basically, the cigarettes smoked today are the deadliest that have ever been made. The cigarettes smoked 150, 200 years ago, the small cigars, they were less deadly because they were not inhaled. So you'd want to return to this pre-industrial cigarette model if you were going to keep smoking cigarettes, and that would be a safer cigarette or less deadly cigarette.
Sure. So the tobacco industry has claimed for decades that there has not been evidence or enough evidence that cigarettes cause cancer. When did scientists first make the link between the two?
Well, in terms of general cancer, it actually goes all the way back to the 18th century. Already in the 18th century, you have scientists in England and in Germany identifying tobacco as a cause of lip cancer, tongue cancer, mouth cancer. And that's already pretty well established in the mid-19th century. So President Grant, Ulysses Grant, he dies of throat cancer that's widely attributed to his fondness for cigars. So that part is pretty well known. New information starts coming in the 20th century because of these inhalable cigarettes. You start getting the world's first lung cancers. Lung cancer was such a rare disease prior to 1900 that there are only 140 known cases worldwide in the entire medical literature. Extremely rare. It was so rare that a medical professor, if they found a case among their patients, they'd bring all their students in and they'd say, look, this is a lung cancer. You may never see another one in your entire career. Today in the United States, it kills 160,000 Americans every year. It's by far the most deadly and most important cancer. That's because of the spread of inhalable cigarettes. And that starts being noticed by doctors in the 1920s and 30s. They start doing experiments to prove it. Germans are actually the first to start doing epidemiology to nail it down. And then there's a whole wave of studies in the 1950s, animal experiments, and they do pathology. They start cutting open in deceased smokers, people who didn't die of smoking but died from an auto accident or something. They found that even those people had severe changes in their lung cell, their tissues, pathologies that could be attributed to smoking. So the 1950s is the turning point, and that's when the industry launches its massive denial campaign.
The program is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and I'm speaking with Robert Proctor. He's a historian of science and the author of Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. So one very interesting part of this story, and something that you've explored in another book, The Nazi War on Cancer, was the Nazis' involvement in the history of science of cigarettes and the politics of cigarettes. And obviously their reasons were hateful and their own, but they ended up opposing and going to war on cigarettes as part of a war against cancer.
That's right.
Tell us about this really sort of fascinating and disturbing episode.
Well, I wrote my first book, actually. It was called Racial Hygiene, Medicine Under the Nazis, and it's about the horrible crimes of Nazi medicine and how doctors were not just victims of the regime, but actually pioneers who actually picked up the racial policies of the United States and other countries and applied them, generalized them, and ended up killing millions of people on the basis of those racial policies. But I noticed when writing that book, that they kept talking, that the Nazis would often talk about cancer and the need to fight cancer, and they were very worried about chemical carcinogens and threats to the body, threats to the racial Nordic body, in sort of the same way that in American early environmental rhetoric is often tinged with racism. So you have something like the Save the Redwoods League of California is spearheaded by a lot of eugenicists who were pro-Nazi, as if sort of the Redwoods were the sort of the Aryans of the forest. And in the same sort of way, in Nazi Germany, there was this notion that we need to return to a natural lifestyle, a healthy lifestyle, There were organic gardens in Dachau, the biggest organic gardens in the world, in fact. And they knew or started appreciating that cancer is also caused by chemicals in the air we breathe, the water. They were the first culture to realize that asbestos causes mesothelioma, the lung cancer of the chest. They're the first to really talk about radon causing lung cancer, and they're the strongest and some of the first to talk about cigarettes as this alien poison that was infecting the populace. So Hitler, when he's about to invade Poland in the middle of the night, he's talking about ways to cure and prevent cancer. So I wrote a whole book about that to try to understand this world, in a way, this horror, this mixture of modernism and catastrophe of the Nazis. And so it's just one of those things. You know, the Nazis were pioneers of rocketry and computing and all kinds of things like this, and of cancer prevention. And, you know, that's the reality of history. But in fact, it is amazing. They were the first to really prove that smoking caused lung cancer.
How much of the Nazis' orientation came out of some pre-existing currents within Germany? Because obviously, the turn of the century, people were into hiking and vegetarianism and all sorts of things, which seem very perhaps hippie from our standpoint. Clearly, you're also saying that there was this whole overlay of their ideology about purity and the pure body and a fixation with the body.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. The Nazism itself comes out of multiple traditions. You know, their capitalist aspects, their anti-capitalist aspects, their organic aspects, their futuristic, technocratic aspects. So it's a complex ideology in and of itself, and you're exactly right. It's building upon the von der Weg movement, the organic movement, the biological movement, certain movements of romanticism, obviously anti-Semitism, some notions that the Jews are kind of an urban phenomenon that is threatening this forest people. So the nativism of the Nazis is certainly key, and they're building on many of these other traditions.
So you mentioned the 1950s as a sort of turning point, both in, I guess, a more widespread recognition of the links between cigarettes and cancer, and also of the tobacco industry's already formidable ability to propagate its message, but it kind of really ratcheted it up in the 1950s. What was happening then that led to these shifts?
Well, the turning point that breaks the camel's back, so to speak, is a December 1953 paper by Ernst Winder, Everts Graham, and Adele Kroninger. And it's what they did is they condensed smoke, and they took this tarry condensed smoke and painted on the backs of experimental mice, and they showed that you could produce skin cancer this way. And it was already known that the tissues of the back of the mouse are similar to the tissues inside the lung. They're both epithelial tissues, so that's a comparable tissue. And this caused an uproar. It caused the stock values to drop 5 to 10%, which was a big deal back then, of all the tobacco companies. There was a catastrophe. They call it the emergency in the tobacco industry. And so they met. They had a secret meeting at the Plaza Hotel on December 14th, 1953. And this is the beginning of the world's deadliest conspiracy. They hired the public relations firm of Hill and Knowlton to orchestrate a massive, ultimately global conspiracy to deny the hazards of smoking, basically using science to fight science, where through an elaborate distraction campaign, they would support science implicating air pollution, chemicals, diet, viruses, your genetics, your psychology, your personality, anything that could be used to distract attention from tobacco. They produced this science, and a lot of it was actually good science. It was just sort of off topic. I think of it as data chaff, you know, where you're sort of throwing out this metal to deflect an attack from your bomber. That's what they were doing. They were saying this elaborate distraction campaign. It was extremely successful because they were able to capture liberal rhetorics of openness. You know, we don't want to close our minds. We don't want to close this issue. We need to stay open to the possibility there are other factors. You know, what are you, you know, do you have a closed mind? Are you going to close your mind? And so they were able to capture liberal rhetorics in actually a brilliant way that ultimately provided also the model for climate denialism and a number of other things. And so it really was a stroke of marketing genius that kept a lot of people confused for decades.
So how did the government respond to this massive campaign? Clearly, governments anywhere can benefit handsomely. On the one hand, of course, they may have populations that they have to treat because they end up with cancer. But on the front of it, you can take massive taxes off of tobacco revenues if a government wants to do, and clearly that's very widespread.
No, that's exactly right. I have a chapter in the book called The Double Addiction or The Second Addiction, because governments throughout the world depend upon tobacco for their revenues. And the amounts are massive. In the 1880s already, tobacco tariffs were a third of the entire U.S. government income. In 1950, cigarettes were 20% of the entire income of the British state. In China, in the 90s, tobacco taxes were 12% of the entire revenue of China. Or in the Nazi period, cigarette taxes were still 10% of the entire income of the state. And not only that, but the brown shirts actually got two-thirds of their entire income. I'm talking about the stormtroopers, the so-called Schutzabteilung, Sportabteilung. They were getting about two-thirds of their entire income was just from tobacco taxes. So governments throughout the world, basically there's a kind of a schizophrenia. The health ministries hate it because it is the world's largest cause of death, cigarettes. On the other hand, the finance ministries love it because it produces this enormous, steady tax revenue. You have an addicted population. They'll pay almost anything for cigarettes. So states love it. And so there's been that tension ever since.
So what about in the case of the United States? So in the 1950s, this information starts coming out about the connection of cigarettes to various cancers. And the tobacco industry goes on the offensive, raising all these questions of doubt. There may not be enough evidence. Let's keep probing. Let's keep looking. We need to gather more evidence, or it could be something else. How did the U.S. government respond to all of that?
Well, fairly quickly, U.S. government agencies, which were responsible for cancer, like the National Cancer Institute and the Surgeon General's Office, the public health, they fairly quickly in the 1950s recognized this as a health disaster. The British gave a prompt in 1962 because there was a Royal College of Physicians report on smoking and health that showed that this really was causing mass death in Britain and anywhere else cigarettes were smoked. President Kennedy was asked about this report, and he didn't know about it. He didn't know about this link between smoking and cancer. He and Jackie, they were both smokers, as were most people. Actually, in the early 60s, about three-quarters of all college students, male and female, were smoking. So smoking was ubiquitous. People didn't know. And so Kennedy asked that a Surgeon General do a report on this. This was then published in 1964. But what's interesting about this is that President Johnson then was asked by his young Assistant Secretary of Health, Joseph Califano, to endorse the Surgeon General's report. And Johnson said, no, if we come out against tobacco, we'll lose the South to the Republicans. We've already suffered for the whites with civil rights. This is a bigger issue even than civil rights, and the Democratic Party will lose power if we go against tobacco. And as a result, no president said anything about the cigarette-tobacco link until Jimmy Carter in 1977. That, even though ever since the National Cancer Act of the 30s, the president had issued actually a statement on cancer every year, but it's not until Jimmy Carter that there was even any mention of tobacco causing death by any president.
Against the Grain is the program. I'm Sasha Lilly. We'll return with Robert Proctor after this music break. Thank you. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and I'm joined today by the author of what is arguably the now definitive work on the tobacco industry. It's called The Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition, and it's published by University of California Press. The author is Robert Proctor, and he's a historian of science at Stanford, author of, amongst other books, The Nazi War on Cancer and Cancer Wars. So I want to ask you more about the many faceted way that the tobacco industry has gone about trying to do everything it can to keep people from making definitive links between cigarettes and cancer, taking actions to shut down the tobacco industry. We'll talk about some of the more recent events later in the program, but you mentioned funding certain science to distract, but there have been a whole number of other ways that the tobacco industry has gone about confusing people and basically tying people to the tobacco industry. So I want to ask you about academia specifically and the ways in which academia has been, at times or in places, bound up with the politics of the tobacco industry.
Yeah. In the book, I call it the most serious threat to academic integrity since the Nazi period, because we're talking about literally thousands of scholars from every discipline being captured by the tobacco industry and used as expert witnesses or to testify in before Congress or to do special secret projects along the denialist direction or simply to advocate for smoking rights, rights of people to smoke on airplanes or in any public space. And it's the support comes through many different directions. It comes through secret projects where they'll fund a scholar to say that there's not enough evidence that secondhand smoke is bad for you. They do often a lot of things even with standards. Like, for example, the whole notion of evidence-based medicine is partly the result of a guy named Alvin Feinstein at Yale, who was a clinical epidemiologist there and one of their very first secret project operatives. And he was hired basically to develop standards of epidemiology such that basically nothing could jump over the bar. And so it was a kind of a scientific puritanism, you might say, where basically you had to prove everything so hard that it was impossible to prove anything. And this became known as essentially evidence-based medicine. But they supported all kinds of people. They supported, in my field, for example, history. They supported scholars to say that everyone has always known about the hazards of smoking, but it's basically never really been proven. They called it the chicken noodle soup defense. Basically, we've always known that chicken noodle soup is good for you, but we've only recently proven it. And the same sort of argument was everyone knew cigarettes were deadly, but the scientists couldn't prove it. And they used this in court to say that, well, if you started smoking at age 11 in 1951, then you knew it would cause, you know, Berger syndrome and breast cancer and lung cancer. It's the so-called common knowledge defense. And just in my field alone, there are over 50 professors who've testified in court for the industry, and only three who've testified against the industry. And I was the first. And then the second one was basically run out of the shop because they really do make your life miserable if you do testify against them. So it's been quite hard. And the asymmetry of power is so great that they're able to harness all of this academic authority. And it's why we still have cigarettes, the world's deadliest product, the product that should have been banned with the Consumer Product Safety Commission or when it was first found to be deadly in 1953. It should have been banned then. The tobacco industry thought it would be banned. But we live in a world of tobacco exceptionalism where basically the industry's political power is so great they've been able to keep themselves on the market.
An earlier version of your book, Golden Holocaust, was subpoenaed by the tobacco industry, although a court ultimately blocked it. What sort of hoops do critical scholars like yourself have to jump through because of that sort of looming legal threat from big tobacco?
Well, you do have to be willing to stand in the face of the hurricane and let it blow over you. the strength you have is the truth is on your side, and that matters a lot. In my particular case, the university I was at Stanford helped me. I did have to hire a lawyer though and pay $50,000 of my own money to ward off their efforts to get my email and my unpublished manuscript. But luckily I was able to withstand that. It's not an easy thing. It's a little bit like being a whistleblower, I guess. But I think that's true of anyone who takes on a big industry. You have to be willing to take the heat.
What does the word agnotology mean?
Well, agnotology is a term that actually I asked a friend of mine, Ian Bowl of the Retort Collective, to coin in the early 1990s. I was interested in having a word which would be sort of the flip side of epistemology, the study of knowledge. We needed a term for the study of ignorance and the manufacture of ignorance, because there were all of these industries I was studying: petrochemical industry, asbestos industry, the salt industry, you name it. For everything that's bad for you, there's an institute whose job it is to show you that it's good for you. And they basically create ignorance. It's a form of propaganda, but it's not so much to convince you of a particular doctrine as to basically leave your mind blank, or to leave it so that you think more research needs to be done, to create uncertainty. And so agnotology was this notion that we came up with of the study of ignorance, the study of the creation of ignorance.
So a word that would be very applicable now to debates over global warming.
Yeah, very, very much so, because the global warming denialists basically come straight out of the tobacco playbook. They actually were funded by them, and in fact, a lot of the institutes that are now involved in global warming denial do get tobacco industry funding. And so these joint conspiracies are very closely linked.
And as you point out in the book, there is another connection, which most of us don't think about, which is that tobacco is implicated actually in global warming.
Yeah, that's right. This is something that smokers don't realize. Basically, when you smoke a cigarette, you're basically not only contributing to the Republican Party directly, but you're also contributing to global warming denial in two different ways. One, you're supporting the engines that are funding global warming denial, these free market fundamentalist think tanks. But you're actually also contributing to global warming, because the cigarette is a massive industrial operation. It takes a huge amount of petrochemical resources. Millions of pounds of pesticides are sprayed onto tobacco every year. There's about 20 Manhattans of old growth forest that are cut down every year just to make the charcoal, to make the flue curing, to make the tobacco. There's other fields that are cut down. So the transport, the paper, the propaganda, just the $12 billion that goes into marketing and promotion, these are all industrial enterprises, the transportation, that have a huge carbon footprint. And I do calculations in the book that say, basically, if you were to get rid of cigarettes in the United States, it would be immediately like taking 4 million cars off the road in terms of the global warming footprint. But that doesn't even count the fact that cigarettes are the major cause of forest fires. Cigarettes are a leading cause of industrial accidents, explosions. There are all kinds of resources used up in the process. And medical care itself, since tobacco is the leading cause of death, disability, and disease, and since medical care also has a huge carbon footprint, it actually ends up also causing environmental harm indirectly through the physical harm. So there's a movement to get rid of cigarette filters in California because they're a form of litter. But I think what we're going to see is actually the banning of cigarettes, simply because they're such a cause of global warming.
Listeners would be, or many listeners anyway, would be surprised to know that the tobacco industry has managed to make its way to fund organizations like the American Civil Liberties Union, which one would imagine there would be no connection whatsoever between the two.
Yeah.
And it really gives you a sense of the very long reach for the tobacco industry.
That's right. In the same way they were able to capture liberal rhetorics about science and the need for openness, the open controversy, two sides to every story, they were also able to capture basically liberal rhetorics of freedom in the 1980s and 90s. The industry became the nation's leading distributor of flags, of copies of the Constitution, of copies of the Bill of Rights, because they were essentially trying to turn the right to smoke into a right to free speech. And so they would actually focus on this. One of their Virginia Slims campaigns was "Find Your Voice." Basically, your voice, your speech is your smoking is your speech. And so they captured freedom. And as a result, also started funding the American Civil Liberties Union, which basically was paid to defend the right of smokers to smoke in enclosed spaces, which was really a horrific period for the ACLU. And Philip Morris was giving hundreds of thousands of dollars to the ACLU and got them to defend the rights of smokers to have their freedom of expression through smoking. When, of course, the reality is that smoking is the robbery of freedom. That's why I talk about in my book the importance of abolition and not prohibition, because the opposite of prohibition is freedom, but the opposite of abolition is slavery. And what we really need to realize, and you realize this after talking with smokers, is that smokers don't like the fact they smoke. They feel trapped. They're enslaved by their cigarettes. And freedom is really on the side of abolition. It's not on the side of smoking. And this is one of the big, I think, political points I want to make in the book.
Yes, and of course, the tobacco industry has captured other rhetorics of the left, broadly speaking, such as feminism, as part of its very strategic and conscious niche marketing. I mean, you mentioned Virginia Slims, which positioned itself as a champion of women's autonomy, independence, and strength. But that's just one example of the ways where the tobacco industry seems to be willing to go wherever you are, as long as you'll buy the product at the end.
That's right. And they have a very fascinating victimology as well. Already in the 1960s, they start talking about smokers being forced to sit at the back of the bus. They talk about smokers being lynched. They talk about smokers being second-class citizens and being stigmatized. And they studied these topics very, very carefully to capture this rhetoric of victimization and liberation that basically, again, assigning liberty to smoking. And they were extremely successful in that propaganda and basically making anyone who was anti-smoking or essentially pro-health as a tyrant. And so they loved talking about neco-Nazis, tobacco Taliban, this sort of thing. And they're really quite brilliant. I mean, this is the best that Madison Avenue can buy you, the best ideology, the best propaganda, and it's been extremely successful.
Another niche, if we could call it that, although it's an enormous one, that the tobacco industry has targeted, and it became the subject of a great deal of controversy in the 90s when a lot of lawsuits started multiplying against the tobacco industry, was the targeting of young people. And in your book, Golden Holocaust, you have some striking, I guess might be the word, images of propaganda from the tobacco industry for children, ostensibly to tell them to stay away from cigarettes. But if you sort of just look below the surface, it's actually about enticement.
Yeah, that's right. The campaign to go get kids goes back even to the 1920s, where there's a secret document that says school days are here. They're talking to all the sales force of Reynolds, go out and get that business. But really, the push to market to children doesn't really begin in a big way until the 1960s. And it's during the 1960s that actually the average age of onset of smoking drops from about 16 to about 12. So you have this juvenilization of smoking. And the companies start competing to make the ever more high kick or juiced up or sugary, sort of the way they're doing with vodka now, if it's sort of the sugared vodka industry. But they started capturing kids with this. And then when they finally were caught on this and told it would be better if they would have anti-smoking programs. They did so in a very clever way, as you're mentioning, where they would use what they called a dual rhetoric strategy, where they would craft an image or a campaign which would sound one way to an adult but sound very different to a kid. So it would sound like to an adult that they were being against smoking, when in fact it was a message that would actually where smoking was encouraged as rebellion. So the tobacco industry in various points defines the cigarette and smoking as acceptable rebellion. And they like it when parents tell their kids not to smoke, because then you can rebel against the parent by smoking. It's kind of a perfect formula for forbidding fruit. You know, you tempt by forbidding fruit. And the industry has always loved that. And so that's why they like the warning labels. It's why they like the play with death. And I actually begin the book by talking about a tobacco industry guy coming into my high school in the late 60s, where he said, you know, kids don't smoke. It's not for you. It's like skydiving. It's like riding a motorcycle. It's like having sex. It's like drinking alcohol. It's not for you. It's for adults. It's an adult habit. You don't do it. So, of course, you know, the message was clear. You know, this was a good thing. And that's, they've been brilliant at that.
So what did happen in the 1990s when the tobacco industry finally seemed to be in the spotlight? There were multiple lawsuits that started proliferating. What led to that? And what are the effects, as you see them, of those lawsuits in terms of how much it really has hemmed in the tobacco industry?
Well, the big event was the 1998 Master Settlement Agreement, by which an agreement was reached that the industry would pay basically $300 billion over 25 years. That amounted to around 40 cents per pack of cigarettes, and so the industry basically raised the price by 45 cents so they could make a profit out of it. The biggest legacy I see coming out of that is essentially the disappearance of tobacco from the political agenda. Most people now, and including people on the left, think of tobacco as a solved problem. It's talked about as being in the past, something that we used to smoke, we don't. But the reality is we still have about 330, 340 billion cigarettes smoked every year in the United States, but it's by poor people, by people of color, homeless people, people with mental problems. It's a very downscale addiction. And so the elite who tend not to smoke basically think it's gone away, but it hasn't. It hasn't. It's still the leading killer in the United States. It still kills 440,000 people just in the United States every year. And it's very different from, say, traffic accidents. We actually are down now in the absolute number of traffic fatalities to where we were in 1950, but we're about twice as many tobacco deaths this year as we were in 1950. So the industry has managed to make itself invisible. Smokers, if they choose American Spirit or something like that, they think they're doing something organic. There's still a lot of mythology surrounding tobacco and lots of reasons to get rid of it.
Robert Proctor is my guest on Against the Grain. He is professor of the history of science at Stanford and the author of Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org, and I'm Sasha Lilly. So there's been, as you were just mentioning, a kind of turn away by people who are middle class, upper class, from cigarettes to some degree in the United States. And one can see now that, you know, there has been a shift in terms of public smoking, all sorts of prohibitions on public smoking. One's now seeing these in Europe, some places that, like Britain, where it was sort of hard to imagine that this was possible. Now you can't smoke in restaurants and so on. One imagines, though, that this has affected the profits of the tobacco industry, and it seems that they've turned elsewhere to make those up. Is that accurate? And what's the scale of their sales in the global south?
Right. Well, one interesting thing to point out is that the peak year for production of tobacco cigarettes in the United States was actually 1997. It's surprisingly late. And in that year, 770 billion cigarettes were sold. Now, a lot of those were not sold in the United States because ever since the Reagan period, there was a big push through the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative to get countries of the world that were not allowing people to buy American cigarettes to have our cigarettes. And so we forced open markets in Japan and in Taiwan and basically all over Asia and many parts of Africa, destroyed a lot of the monopolies. And as a result, you're getting a globalization of the cigarette. The big companies that make them, the transnationals like Philip Morris and Reynolds and British American Tobacco and Japan Tobacco, and then I should also say the Chinese state, which is the world's largest producer of cigarettes now by a fairly large margin. And China National Tobacco Company has this hope of becoming the global tobacco superpower. They produce about 40% of the world's cigarettes. On the other hand, the other companies are pretty big too, like Philip Morris International is a $150 billion company. And a lot of those profits are coming from Eastern Europe, from Africa, from Asia. So they've really turned to this as the next big thing. And they're doing all of the same tricks that they tried here. They're bullying countries like Australia, which is leading the path for a lot of anti-smoking measures. They've introduced plain package legislation just this year. So for the first time, you're going to have these olive drab packets with no brand ad, because the packet itself has become this last bastion of advertising and propaganda, you might say. So they've gotten rid of that in Australia. But as a result, the big companies are trying to crush this in Australia. So it's going to be a global battle that's going to go on for several years.
We started the program by talking about a number which is really a staggering number of predicted deaths worldwide in the 21st century if smoking continues on the rates that they currently are. And that's 1 billion people, which is a sort of mind-blowing number. If that does continue, would the majority of those deaths be in the global south? And how likely do you think it is that we will see that actual number of people dying coming to pass?
Right. Yeah. Remember, only 100 million people died of smoking in the 20th century, and we're on pace for 1 billion deaths, 10 times that. So the epidemic is definitely in the future. But I actually think that now with some of the World Health treaties that are coming on, some of the activism, I think what it's going to take is local communities and small states to take initiative. Because people really have no idea how much power they actually have to fight the industry. For example, any community in the United States could decide overnight to ban the sale of cigarettes. That's fully within their power. One of the things the industry has managed to do is basically strip us of our imaginative power. 15 different states in the late 19th century, early 20th century, actually banned the sale of tobacco. And that right to ban at the state level was upheld by the U.S. Supreme Court. Every community, if the town of Richmond or Berkeley wanted to ban the sale of cigarettes tomorrow, they could do that. They fully have that power. And I think that's what's going to happen. You're going to see local communities taking it on. We're already seeing it in places like Bhutan now bans the sale of cigarettes. You have the state of Tasmania. In Australia, they have a program they're trying to implement where no one born past the year 2000 will be allowed to buy cigarettes. There are measures that could be taken by the FDA to remove nicotine, for example, from cigarettes, or to, as I mentioned, to raise the pH above 8 again. So there are all kinds of things that could be done, and I think actually will be done, partly from these environmental reasons we were talking about.
So you support an outright ban, is that correct? Because obviously there is a history of substances being made illegal and then creating their own black markets and all sorts of problems with that. How would a ban compare to the other thing that you mentioned, or one of the other possibilities, raising the pH of the tobacco and cigarettes so that people would not inhale it into their lungs, or one of these sort of, in a sense, technical fixes versus outright making them unavailable?
Well, I think we've got to move in all those directions simultaneously. The reason I support a ban on the sale of cigarettes is that smoking is fundamentally not a recreational drug. That is, smoking of tobacco is not a recreational drug. Almost all smokers say they wish they didn't smoke. What we call regret studies show that almost all smokers of cigarettes come to regret having ever started to smoke, especially once they're diagnosed with an illness. Remember that half of all smokers will die from an illness caused by tobacco, and that's very different from alcohol. It's very different from marijuana. Alcohol is much more like marijuana. Those are recreational drugs, and I think the key that differentiates is the fact that smokers don't like the fact they smoke. So even from a libertarian point of view, getting rid of this, the world's most addictive drug, would actually be a liberating act and not something negative.
I wanted to ask you finally about how you went about doing the research that is put together in this rather stunning book, Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. You had access to an enormous trove of documents from the tobacco industry that was brought to light by lawsuits against the cigarette companies. Why is this mass of data so important, and how were you able to make sense of it given the sheer volume?
Yeah. Well, it really is a wonderful treasure. It's 80 million pages of secret industry documents. It's the largest business archive in the world that's searchable. And you can search any term you want, whether, you know, you could search documents that say, please destroy. You can search documents that say, castorium. Search anything you want. And it the only limit is your imagination, really. And so I've been working in these archives for over a decade, and anyone can use them. They're completely online at the UCSF Legacy Library. Anyone can search it. I teach classes using those archives, and it's stunning what's in there about China, about Switzerland, about global climate, about basically any topic you name is in there, just because it's so large. And we really need to see more archives like that. And it's giving a kind of transparency to this industry that makes it hard for them to do business as usual.
We have a link to that archive on our website, againstthegrain.org. Robert Proctor, thank you so much for coming in and talking to me.
Well, thank you, Sasha. Great to be with you.
I've been speaking with the author of Golden Holocaust, Origins of the Cigarette Catastrophe and the Case for Abolition. That's published by the University of California Press, and we also have a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Robert Proctor teaches in the history of science at Stanford and is the author of many books, including Cancer Wars and Racial Hygiene. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, submit comments, and find ways to reach us. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or look up Against the Grain Radio on Facebook